Okay, I'm ready. Let's get started.
Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
Todd Raspberry found himself in a jam. That's how the case actually started. If you're wondering who the author of the opinion I'm going to talk about today was, it was Judge Selya in the First Circuit. And I love reading his opinions and his decisions. There's always a half dozen words in there that I don't know what they mean. So it's all a challenge. I have to read them with a dictionary because Judge Selya's taken it upon himself to increase the vocabulary of every lawyer in the country, which is a good thing, I guess. There's always a lot of interesting things. But he's also got a sense of humor. Todd Raspberry found himself in the jam. The first sentence of the case of the week this week. Welcome to Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar, and I call this the case of the raspberry jam. And if you're thinking, well, maybe the name's misspelled, it's actually, it's not. There's no P in it in the surname in the way that it's spelled. And the case this week is United States versus Raspberry. It's a First Circuit case, as you probably already figured out. I told you Judge Selya wrote the opinion. This is the seventh edition in 2018 of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar, and this case is dated February 14th, 2018. I was going to use this one a few weeks ago, but one thing led to another, and with all the travel, I saved it. It's such a fun case and a good case, even though it's more than 3 weeks old. I'm going to go ahead and stick with it. The key phrases, concepts and key phrases for this particular case, consent to search. We've got some interesting consent issues that they really don't go into much, but I'll talk about it a little bit. The Terry stop, Terry frisk, arrest, including the concept of a de facto arrest, and when the Terry stop might morph into a de facto arrest. And then the concept of search incident to arrest. Key cases, it seems like we always have Terry versus Ohio in there, and we do. Michigan v. Long is an interesting case, and we're going to talk about that for a little bit. And Minnesota versus Dickerson, which is an extension of the Michigan v. Long decision. And then California versus Chimmel, although it's not actually cited in this opinion, but it's key to the opinion itself, even though it's not really mentioned. So I kind of put it in there with an asterisk for a key case. And so let's jump into it in this case, the case of the raspberry jam. Let me give you the facts. Always good to kind of know what's going on in this case. And it started with this investigation. It's a drug investigation, and it's taken place up near Portland, Maine, and where I just came from. I can tell you, and it was the headline of the news the 2 weeks that I just spent up in Washington County, Maine. You read the paper, you watch the evening news on the local channels, and they've got a really, really bad opioid addiction issue up there. And obviously, you know, it's a lot easier and a lot cheaper to get your hands on heroin these days than it is on the Oxy. So a lot of drug distribution going on up there, a lot of heroin as a result of this the terrible opioid addiction crisis that we have, which is really, it's really bad up there in that part of New England and in and around Portland. So that's what it's, we got this drug investigation going on. There's a DEA special agent, Special Agent Wolf. He's been on the trail of a person that's known to him as Champagne, which is interesting because that's the name of my Labrador retriever. And I'm using quotes here because this is the language that Judge Selya used. You know, the written opinion's always fun to read. And so Wolf is on the trail of Champagne. And Special Agent Wolf, this DEA agent, he ends up apprehending a female accomplice of this person that this major drug dealer that he only knows by the nickname, the alias Champagne. He's been looking for this guy. It's been really, really hard to locate him. He finally gets a lead. And the lead indicates that his name is actually Todd Raspberry. The Champagne, the name of this person is actually named Todd Raspberry. And so he uses a confidential informant. He's able to track down one of Raspberry's accomplices while she's actually making drug deliveries in Portland, Maine. So he goes up to this person. She's apprehended. She surrenders heroin that she's carrying. And she becomes very, very cooperative, probably trying to make a better deal for herself, and told Wolf that Raspberry right now, along with more drugs, is in a motel room that she had rented in nearby Scarborough, Maine. And so she says, look, I rented this room. He's got more heroin in the room. He's in the room right now. And here's a key to the room. You can go search it. So she consents to search the room that is in her name and not in his name. And that becomes important, obviously, with the concept of consent. So he tracks down the accomplice. She gives him the heroin and the information and consent. And then he goes to the hotel room. He tries the key. The key to the room doesn't work. We had another case not too long ago, a case out of the Eighth Circuit where they had the same situation. They get a key to the room and it doesn't work. What do you do when the key doesn't work? Well, what do you do when the key doesn't work? He's got consent to search the room. He knocks on the door. And when he knocks on the door, Raspberry actually answers the door. And he asks them, and this is a task force, so there's federal and local law enforcement officers that are doing this. They ask him whether or not he's a guest in the room, and he confirms that he's a guest in the motel room, which had been rented by the woman who the agent Wolf had spoken to earlier. So that becomes very important because the consent that she provided, that means the consent that she provided to search the room is valid vis-a-vis Raspberry. They don't have to have his consent. They have her consent. He's just a guest. And she's the one who's rented the room. And if it was one of those co-ownership, joint renters types of situation, if he said no and she said yes, and they couldn't go in. But since he's just a guest, that's not whatever he feels. He can't say anything to overcome the consent that she has given as the one who is the lawful occupant and has the right to the room because it's rented by her. So there you go. He says that he's a guest. They go in. They tell him that they have consent to search the room. And when they move in to search, they detain him. He is handcuffed. And then he's partially frisked. They just quickly, since he's cuffed, they quickly pat down around the waistband area. And that's it. That's the only place they pat down. And then they search the room. They don't find drugs, but they find drug distribution paraphernalia. They find the baggies. They find scales. They find other types of things that are used for drug distribution, but they haven't found any drugs. And so he says, hey, look, since you didn't find anything, can you get these cuffs off of me? Can you take these cuffs off of me now? He wants out of the cuffs. And understand it's been about 20 minutes since the detention initially started. So he's been detained for close to 20 minutes at this point. And they say, yeah, but before we take the cuffs off, we're going to pat you down thoroughly, more thoroughly than we did when we first put the cuffs on, not just the waistband. And they do a full pat down. And when they do, they find this bulge in the groin area. And the officer said it's about the size of a softball. And so it's, you know, rather large. And they ask him what it is. And he says it's a part of his anatomy. Basically telling that he's got a softball-sized testicle. And the officers didn't believe it for 5 seconds. They reach in his pants, and they pull this object out, and it is indeed a softball-sized thing of heroin. So that the heroin in the room that they found was in his pants as a result of when they did this secondary frisk. So you kind of know what's going to come here. We go to trial. At trial, you get the defense attorney uses the defense attorney F word. That's not fair. I'm going to file those motions to suppress, like they always do. I mean, prosecutors, we know this is coming. In fact, that I've often indicated a lot of times these things are won or lost in pretrial and these suppression hearings. But we expect there's going to be at least one or two arguments made, sometimes three or four. And in this case, there were four arguments were made. First, they said that the detention that was unlawful, so that he was unlawfully detained, not in the fact that they had the reasonable suspicion from the beginning. They don't argue that the detention was unlawful based on the lack of reasonable suspicion. They based on the manner of the detention, that they say that the way that he was detained, both in the duration, the 20-minute duration, and the fact that he was cuffed and the way that he was kept, was unlawful. Basically, they're saying that it became a de facto arrest. The way that they detained him became a de facto arrest, which requires probable cause. A formal arrest or de facto arrest, either way, if it's an arrest, you have to have probable cause. And they're saying they didn't have that at that point, and the detention, therefore, was unlawful. They said the use of handcuffs was unreasonable for a detention and that the duration of the detention itself was unlawful. And then the second frisk, they frisked him once for weapons. When they frisked him, they didn't find anything and they put him in cuffs. And the defense is arguing that at the point that they frisked him a second time, they no longer had a reasonable suspicion he was presently armed and dangerous because they had already frisked him once before he was detained for 20 minutes in handcuffs. And so the second, they're saying there was no reasonable suspicion anymore that he was presently armed and dangerous during the second frisk, that frisk was unlawful. And even if that frisk is lawful, that frisk itself could not lead to the seizure of the object under the plain touch doctrine because the object wasn't immediately apparent under the rule as developed of what's required for that judicially recognized exception for that JRE, that the object itself wasn't immediately apparent to be contraband, and therefore the plain touch doctrine did not apply. So there you go. That's the arguments that are there. They make those arguments at trial. The district court judge denies the motions to suppress, and he ends up going through. They preserve it for appeal, and now we're up on appeal on these decisions on the denial of the motion to suppress. The issues on appeal are: did the detention exceed lawfully? Did it exceed the scope of a lawful Terry stop such that it became unlawful? Was the manner in which he was kept and the duration, in the cuffs and for 20 minutes, did that create an unreasonable Terry stop? Even though it was okay in the beginning to do the stop, was the manner and of it, did it become unreasonable in the scope? And that's not a purely academic type of concern. I mean, you can have a valid Terry stop. It's valid when it starts, but it becomes unreasonable. And remember what Chief Justice Rehnquist said in the Ohio versus Robinette decision, a very famous quote. And to be fair, it came from previous cases as well. But the very, very fundamental concept, the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. So whenever you've got any type of Fourth Amendment question, the concept of reasonableness is going to govern. Did the detention exceed the scope of the Terry stop? Was the second frisk reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, or was it unreasonable? Was it an unlawful search under the Fourth Amendment? Was the seizure of the object justified under the plain touch doctrine, that JRE for plain touch? And was the search of the undershorts reasonable? Going in, searching, and was that reasonable as well? So there you go. They all kind of relate very much to one another in the facts. So let's go ahead and take a look at our legal blast from the past, those key cases that are going to kind of govern this. We can use it as an opportunity to have a quick little refresher on the rules of the rule of law. And obviously, we get Terry. We get Terry a lot, and we've had. It's always good just to go over. But Terry's a key part of this. Both the Terry stop and the Terry frisk. You know, Detective McFadden and that stop back on at the Halloween day in 1963 got two of the most significant JREs that we have, the Terry stop and the Terry frisk. Obviously, one is a seizure and the other one is a search. The Terry stop, that temporary seizure, an investigative seizure, investigative detention based on reasonable suspicion that a person is involved in criminal activity. And it's not a violation of the Fourth Amendment, even the absence of probable cause, but you have to have that reasonable suspicion that they're involved in criminal activity. And then, of course, the Terry frisk, that reasonable suspicion that the person to be frisked is presently armed and dangerous. And so we have those two from the same case. The Michigan v. Long decision in 1983 is the one of the fundamental cases that we have to support the judicially recognized exception, or that JRE known as a plain view seizure. Now, they call it the plain view doctrine. I'll always add the word seizure after that just to make sure it's clear that this is a seizure, a warrantless seizure, judicially recognized exception. The people often misuse the concept, the term plain view. If something is in plain sight, they say, or open view, then those are the terms that you should use. But the plain view, it can get confusing. If someone says, well, I saw it in plain view, that doesn't necessarily mean it can be seized under the plain view seizure doctrine, because being able, having lawful observation of the object to be seized is only one of three of the requirements for this particular judicially recognized exception. In order for there to be a plain view seizure, the object has to be, the observation of the object has to be lawful. The access to the object has to be lawful. And it has to be immediately recognizable. It has to be immediately apparent that the object that is in, that you're viewing is contraband or evidence of criminal activity without any further manipulation or investigation. It has to be immediately apparent. That's the key phrase there, that it is contraband or evidence of criminal activity. And we do get a lot of plain view seizures of drugs, of contraband. And that's the Michigan v. Long case. Now, what about, that's just one sense, right? That's just the sense of sight. What about other senses? Can you have a plain sniff? Can you have a can you hear something? You know, can a plain sound? What about the sense of touch? Can you extend that plain view doctrine in from the sense of sight to the sense of touch? And the Supreme Court said yes in a case from 1993, Minnesota versus Dickerson, and specifically said, and they're talking about a pat-down. So they're talking about the concept of conducting a Terry frisk. And then this is a quote from the case. If a police officer lawfully pats down a suspect's outer clothing and feels an object whose contour or mass makes its identity immediately apparent, there has been no invasion of the suspect's privacy beyond that already authorized by the search for the weapon. So basically, when you're doing a Terry frisk, it is a pat-down frisk where you're looking for weapons, objects that can be used as weapons, because you have that reasonable suspicion a person's presently armed and dangerous. Well, if you're conducting this pat-down frisk looking for weapons and you feel something instead that is immediately apparent to you based on its feel, that it is contraband or evidence criminal activity, then it can be seized under the plain touch seizure doctrine, and there's no invasion beyond that already authorized by the pat down. But that immediately apparent is very, very important, and it gets a little tricky. You know, we don't even really teach that. When I was at FLETC, we don't really get into the plain touch doctrine significantly, because it's so difficult to apply. You can't be a rookie and successfully have a plain touch type of situation. It has to, that when you touch it, you, the argument, when you see these cases that are successful cases, based on the Minnesota versus Dickerson case. Invariably, the officers have a lot of experience, and they've done this a number of times, and they're relying on their experience to make the argument that it was immediately apparent just based on its touch without them actually seeing it. So let's take a look at what the court did with this. It's really kind of interesting in the analysis that they made, because it might not be exactly what you're expecting. First, they said that the detention itself was justified by reasonable suspicion. Now, it's important, they pointed out very, very quickly that the defendant himself never made an argument. They conceded that the initial detention when they first got there was justified under the facts, and that there was a valid Terry stop. They didn't argue that, but they said that the things that happened, that the scope of this detention actually created a situation where it was a de facto arrest when they put him into cuffs. And they kept him for over 20 minutes, and so that what might have been a valid Terry stop initially at some point morphed into a de facto arrest. And since you have to have probable cause in order to have any type of arrest, whether it's a formal arrest or a de facto arrest, that it became a bad domino at that point. And you're going to argue that one of these four dominoes, is the Fourth Amendment dominoes, are bad, so they can keep that last domino out, right? Which is typically a plain view seizure, and in this case, the seizure of the heroin. So the court said, "Hey, look, when they're doing their review of a Terry stop, you got a two-step process. The stop has to be justified at its inception, which the defendant in this case conceded." And secondly, it has to be the actions that are taken while the person's detained have to be reasonably related in scope. So you got that scope thing to determine reasonableness, reasonably related in scope under the circumstances. Now, his argument is that by putting him in cuffs and brandishing weapons and keeping him for 20 minutes, that it exceeded past the Terry stop and made it a de facto arrest. But the First Circuit disagreed. The court said that they didn't have probable cause to arrest him the moment they went in the room. But the rule of Terry allows the police to take steps to protect themselves. And they acknowledge there's no, and the quote is, scientifically precise benchmarks for distinguishing between a temporary detention and a de facto arrest. In other words, they said it's hard to say, there's no precise measure, but they're allowed under, you have to look at a totality of the circumstances, and they're allowed to do things to protect themselves. And that even with the limitations on Terry stops, officers have to be allowed during the course and scope of the stop to take measures that are reasonably calculated to protect them or to protect other people from harm. Now, remember, they're in a hotel room. So if this guy is armed and there's actually shots are fired, you got walls that are very thin, it can endanger other people. And so they noted that concerns for officer safety are even heightened more in the close confines of a hotel room. And plus he was a suspected drug trafficker, and the connection between drugs and violence is legendary. Most of the circuits have acknowledged, if not all of them, that drugs and guns go hand in hand. So even though they're two separate analyses, every once in a while, when you have a case that where the suspicion of the criminal activity that leads to the Terry stop might also be that give you the suspicion that they're presently armed and dangerous, as in with the distribution of drugs. Court said, taking this total mix of facts into account, they agreed with the district court that the officers had a reasonable basis to suspect that Raspberry might be presently armed and dangerous. And they said the 20-minute detention might be a little bit longer than a typical Terry stop, but taken in a vacuum, the time doesn't make it a de facto arrest. And they looked at a bunch of things that were going on. They looked at that they were the officers weren't dragging it out. They were assiduously engaged in activities in furtherance of the investigation, and therefore that this did not the time itself did not convert it into a de facto arrest. So that there was no de facto arrest in the manner of the detention here. And now we get to the point they've searched the room and they found all of this drug paraphernalia, but they have not found drugs. And the defense has a pretty nifty argument here. They say the second Terry frisk was unjustified. And the court said, no, it was justified because the first search was cursory. And since all they did when they put the cuffs on the guy was do a cursory pat down of his waistband, that it was limited, that they didn't, the frisk wasn't thorough enough to dispel that reasonable suspicion that he was presently armed and dangerous. And since they didn't do a full-blown frisk in the beginning, when they went back and they did the more thorough frisk the second time, that that it was justified because they still had a reasonable suspicion he was presently armed and dangerous, even though 20 minutes had gone by and he had been in handcuffs while they were searching the room. And so the court said, when, as here, the first frisk is limited, it will not automatically dispel a reasonable suspicion that the suspect may be armed. And in these circumstances, the second frisk was justified, since the first one was restricted and that there was no error. So the court said the second frisk was justified. This is where it gets a little interesting now, because remember the whole concept of this reasonable suspicion becoming probable cause. The court talked about all of the facts that came together. By the end of the second frisk, not at the beginning, but by the end of the second frisk, the officers had probable cause to arrest him. And when they went to frisk him the second time, they had already found drug paraphernalia in the house. And so they've arrested the accomplice. The accomplice says, I'm staying in a motel room. He's in the motel room. There are drugs in the motel room, and gave him consent to go into the room. And so they're in there looking for drugs. And she said there were drugs in the room, but they didn't find any. The only place that they haven't searched is him inside the room looking for the drugs. She said were in there, and he lied. He lied about the object when he asked about what was in his what was in his pants. He said that it was a part of his anatomy, and they said this is clearly a lie. And if someone who's been detained is clearly lying to police when they're asked questions, then that can help establish the probable cause. And so basically what the court does and what the First Circuit does is they tiptoe, they tap dance around the issue of the plain touch doctrine. And it's probably a good thing, because based on the language that Judge Selya used, he said that basically said that the argument that that there was a plain touch here was very suspect. In other words, it's not a good argument to be made. And I told you, it's very hard to make that argument for the plain touch doctrine. And they said, look, we don't have to do that, because what they're going to say is that since they had probable cause to arrest by the time they got to the end of the second frisk, before they retrieved the heroin out of his pants, they had probable cause to arrest. And so there was a de facto arrest that was occurring. And therefore, when they went into his pants to retrieve that object that they felt during the second frisk, which was valid. Since they now had probable cause to arrest before they found that bag of heroin, that when they went in to search him, that was a search incident to arrest and not a plain touch seizure. So they don't have to answer the question of whether or not it was a plain touch seizure. And it's probably a good thing that they punted on that issue, because if it had to be decided on that, they might not have, the government might not have won the day. But they jumped to that concept that they had probable cause. They even cited some cases that I've talked about in the last few weeks, in the Illinois v. Gates case, and the Florida v. Harris case, and the Ornelas versus United States. They talk about this concept of probable cause as a fluid concept. And they said here, and the totality of the circumstances militate strongly in favor of finding that probable cause existed to arrest Raspberry after the second frisk, but before they went in. And so when they went into his pants to retrieve the object, that it was a search incident to arrest. And that is under the California versus Chimmel case, which I cited, gave you the cite for in the beginning. But I said wasn't cited in this case, and indeed it's not. So I'm not going to go, we'll save that for another day, the whole concept of what you have to have, the three purposes of search incident to arrest under California versus Chimmel. That'd be a good thing for another one. So let's wrap it up now. We got the search incident to arrest was reasonable, and there you go. The motion is suppressed, the evidence is denied. There you go, very interesting case. You know, what about when was he exactly under arrest? Now, remember, the officers in this case said that they didn't arrest him until after they seized the contraband, and they said they did that under plain touch. But even though they didn't formally place him under arrest, it was a de facto arrest at the point in time that Terry stopped, the reasonable suspicion morphed. More facts were obtained that gave them probable cause to effectuate an arrest. Also, at that point where they had probable cause, they probably couldn't talk to him anymore, because now you're with a de facto arrest, you're in arrest-like custody that would trigger Miranda. So that's always keep that in the back of your mind when you're going from a reasonable suspicion situation to a probable cause situation. So very interesting case. Another interesting thing about this case I'd point out is that there on the three-judge panel, one of the judges that was sitting on the three-judge panel was Associate Justice Souter. Retired Supreme Court Justice Souter was sitting on the three-judge panel. Honorable David H. Souter, Associate Justice retired of the Supreme Court of the United States, sitting by designation. So it's good to see him involved in something. He's not on the Supreme Court anymore, but there he is up there in Boston, sitting by designation as one of the three judges on the panel. I mean, that was a little interesting twist as well. Thank you so much for joining me. Time's up. Try and keep it right there to half an hour. Thanks for joining me for this edition of this a broadcast, Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar on Broadcast Blue. Please check out the website, www.broadcast.blue, for information regarding upcoming webinars, how to get into the pod, subscribe to podcasts, how to stream them. And if you could please help me get the word out on Broadcast Blue, forward it around, you may shoot an email out. And
let folks know about Broadcast Blue. Thank you so much. See you again next week.